Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears, along with you on this Monday, November 2nd, 2020, 17 minutes past the hour. And today, with all the hustle and bustle and everything going on, I just want you to forget the world that we live in today for the next 2 hours. Because the date I just mentioned, Monday, November 2nd, 2020, is very important to all of us here in Marion. November 2nd, 1920, Warren G. Harding, Warren Gamaliel Harding, was elected President of the United States. This is the 100th, the centennial anniversary of that big event for all of us here in Marion. You could say 100 years in the making today. And I know we are all very excited. Now, joining me this morning, and at the end of the broadcast this morning, at the end of the 2 hours, I'm going to tell you how we were able to make this happen. But there's only one person you can really interview on this day, and that is President Warren G. Harding. So let's welcome to our microphones a name in Marion that is on buildings, schools, and a whole lot of other things, President Warren G. Harding. President Harding, how are you?
I'm just doing fine, Scott. It's a big, exciting day. We got off to a roaring start this morning, and things are just happening everywhere. There's a lot to talk about.
You know, November 2nd is an interesting day. Now, we all know this is the centennial. This is the day you were elected 100 years ago. But I don't know how many people know that this is your birthday, born November 2nd, 1865.
Yes, actually, I'm 55 years old today. And I think this is the first time a presidential candidate has had the election on his birthday. So we've got lots of firsts, but that's one of them.
Absolutely. Now, Mr. Harding, let's go back and let's just start from the very beginning here. Tell us where you were born and what your childhood was like.
Okay. Well, let's go back to November 2nd, 1865. We're right in the thick of the Civil War. I was born in Corsica, which is a town that nobody's heard of, primarily because it's changed its name. It's now known as Blooming Grove. It's a little town in Morrow County. The reason it changed its name is because there were several Corsicas in Ohio, and by the time the post office was naming the post offices around the state, there were several Corsicas, so they wanted to rename it. And actually, I was in favor of calling it Harding's Corners, because most of the folks that live in Corsica were Hardings or Harding's descendants. The lovely cemetery there with a lot of Harding monuments in it. So Harding's Corners seemed fitting, but no, it became Blooming Grove. My father, George, was a physician. He had gone to school in Cleveland. Of course, back at that time, you were a physician if you said you were. It didn't take a lot of credentials, but he went to school in Cleveland for it. And was a physician in the area. Actually, later, my mother, Phoebe Dickerson, this is her maiden name, She became a physician as well. So both of my parents were doctors. My mother primarily served as a midwife. My father was a general physician. But we also had a small farm, raised grain and chickens and kind of the usual things on a small farm. I had lots of siblings. I grew up with a large family. I had a sister, Charity. We called her Chat. Another, Mary. Eleanor Priscilla was another. I had a brother, Charles. Another sister, Abigail. We called her Daisy. A brother, George. And another sister, Phoebe Caroline. We just called her Caroline. That was an eventful time, really. Just life on a small farm in a small village. My family moved to Caledonia when I was about 10, primarily because it was a larger town, and my father thought there were better prospects for a physician, where there were more people, more families, more children being born. So that's where we moved. I attended the local schoolhouse there until I was about 14. And when I went to school, Ohio Central College in Iberia, I started college at 14 years of age. Now, that doesn't make me a genius, because schooling only went to that to at age of 14, and Iberia Central College was called a normal school. It was a school for teachers primarily, and it wasn't unusual for 14-year-olds, 16-year-olds to start college there. I graduated in 1882. A little story about that. I started a newspaper there while I was in college with my friend Jack Warwick. We called it the Iberia Spectator. I think we published something like a total of 6 issues. But it was the news of the day from the Iberia area and the college. And that's really where I got my start in journalism. I learned that I really enjoyed writing and interviewing, and really got captivated with the news business at an early age.
I want to go back to your childhood just for a second. What do you think, growing up in the home you did, with the siblings you did, with the parents you had, what did that teach you for the rest of your life? What lessons did you learn?
Well, I learned the value of hard, honest work. My family had a strong work ethic. When I was in Caledonia, age 10, a little after, at that time, the railroad was just coming through Caledonia, and even though I was just a boy, I got a job on the roadbed crew, excavating and leveling the roadbed and moving gravel, and that's pretty hard work for a young boy. It didn't pay well, but I learn the value of an honest dollar. On my father's farm, he had given me, or at least loaned me, a small piece of ground to farm on my own. And I think it was a 13-acre patch. I was allowed to keep whatever proceeds came off of that, raised wheat on it, And I think at the end of the harvest, I earned $13. And I've got to tell you, I never felt richer in my entire life. That $13 and all of the months of work that it took to earn it taught me a valuable lesson about good, honest work and the proceeds that you can get from it.
The time from graduating from college and the time until you got involved in newspapers, journalism, what was that period of time like in your life? What did you want to be?
Well, honestly, I didn't know. I'd gone to college at Iberia. Since it was a normal school for teachers, I started out as a teacher. In fact, I taught at a one-room school in a white school building just north of Marion, at the corner of Route 4 and Marion Williamsport Road. There's where it stood. I did that for one season, and I can just tell you the pay was miserable. No self-respecting man should be earning a living in that way. That was not for me. So I took a job as an insurance salesman. Tried that for a little while, and well, that didn't work out quite so well. I learned that I wasn't good with numbers. Words, yes, words were a strength, but not numbers. I wrote an insurance policy for a man that promised far too many benefits for far too little premiums, and the insurance company terminated my contract, and that was that. So teaching was out, insurance was out. I tried my hand at law. They called that reading law. What you did, you didn't go to school for law, you apprenticed with a lawyer and read a lot of books. And so I read law for a while, and soon developed a distaste for that. But then I fell back on the little journalism experience that I had with the Iberia Spectator. And I got a job with the Caledonia newspaper. It was a paper called the Caledonia Argus. And I started there as a printer's devil. It's kind of a nickname for the guy that sets type. That was at a time when all of the type in a newspaper was set by hand. Each little piece of lead type, each little letter had to be assembled in rows of type to make sentences and columns. That was called sticking type, where you actually put the type on a stick that was made to hold it, and use that to build each line of type for each page. Very tedious work. You have to be extremely precise. Have to be literate, because your proofreading is as you go. So that's how I got my start, and then I started taking some writing assignments and starting to feel like a full-fledged reporter.
What did you learn about journalism from those early newspapers, Caledonia and Iberia?
Well, I learned that journalism is an honorable profession. At least it can be an honorable profession when it's practiced with discipline and ethics. I learned the basics that I later turned into what I called the Star Creed. When the Marion Star was up and running, and we actually had a staff of reporters. I posted on the wall the major points, rules basically, that I expected each reporter to abide by. And actually, I asked them to memorize it. About a dozen points to it. Here are some of them. One is, remember there are two sides to every question. Get them both. Point two, be truthful. Get the facts. Point three, mistakes are inevitable, but strive for accuracy. I always told my reporters that I'd rather have one story exactly right than 100 half wrong. Be decent, be fair, and be generous. This next one I think is almost the most important. Boost. Don't knock. Because there's good in everybody. And it really is the role of the journalist to bring out the good and never needlessly hurt the feelings of anybody. That rule served me well in journalism. It helped build a reputable, thriving newspaper business, and it certainly served me well later on in all of my political journeys. Another point is, in reporting a political gathering, always give the facts. Don't tell the story the way you want to have it. You tell the story the way it is. There's always a lot of political news in the newspapers, but I learned that it was important to treat all parties alike. If there's any politics that's going to be played, we'll play that out in our editorial columns. In the stories, they'll be played straight and fair. It's also important to treat all religious matter reverently and to respect everybody's faith. If it can be possible, avoid bringing embarrassment to an innocent man, woman, or child by telling the misdeeds or misfortunes of a relative. That goes back to boost, don't knock. Don't wait to be asked, but do it without asking. And above all, be clean and never let a dirty word or suggestive story ever get into type. In the end, I want this newspaper to be conducted in a way that it can go into any home without the destroying the innocence of any child that lives there. So by putting all of those elements of the creed together, that formed the basis of honorable, reputable reporting in my newspaper, and also the basis for the ethics behind my political career.
Now, Mr. Harding, this is very interesting, and I want to go back and pick up how the Marion Star came to be under Warren Harding, but since you've mentioned those points that were on the wall, I think this is an interesting question, an interesting conversation to have with you on this particular day. And correct me if I'm wrong about any of this, but when you were at the Marion Star working day to day, you did write some columns. Now, I think they would be considered editorial and not news, and there is, I think, a differentiation there. But under your own rules, not to hurt people, to be fair, not to knock people. In those editorials that you wrote, do you think you always maintained your own rules?
Well, no, because editorial writing is a different breed from journalistic writing. Journalistic writing is about the facts, the story, all sides, being fair and equitable to everybody involved. Editorial writing is opinion, pure and simple. And in most cases, that was my opinion. I clearly labeled it as opinion, as editorial content. I think it was clear to any reader that this wasn't news. This was an opinion piece, an op-ed piece. And I was always careful to draw the distinction between the two, so that nothing about my own opinion could be misconstrued as some sort of fact because it was reported in the paper.
Did you ever give any thought when you decided to start writing these editorials to do I want to write news stories or do I want to write editorials? And why did editorials appeal to you?
Well, editorials create opinion. Not only my opinion, editorials can create opinion for a community. Editorials can set the pace, set the agenda for a community. Now, many of my editorials were political in nature. Clearly, I had opinions. I was a staunch Republican, am a staunch Republican in a highly Democratic county. Marion County was largely under Democratic rule. So I was a minority opinion. But I expressed it freely. I also use that editorial space to be a booster for Marion. You see, when my partners and I took over the Star, Marion was a mud rut town. And over the years, through my editorials, I encouraged Marion to grow up and put on its long pants and start acting like a city. So I pushed for improvements in Marion that included things like natural gas lines. We didn't have any. Later on, a natural gas plant was built in Marion on Columbia Street and started feeding gas into homes. Sanitary sewer lines, Marion didn't have any. I thought it was important that electricity was coming on as a valuable resource, yet Marion didn't have an electric plant. So I wrote an editorial, several actually, promoting electricity and the need to get an electric plant going in Marion, and based on that editorial, some investors got together and built one. I wrote editorials on the need to have our streets paved. Everybody was tired of the mud ruts, especially in the spring. Now, that wasn't entirely a popular decision. I mean, I was just issuing an editorial. The council of the era put together a plan that started to pave the city streets, but that was done at the expense of the property owners. It was done through an assessment. So as the Marion streets started to be paved, those bills were paid by the people who owned property along that street. That wasn't a popular thing. But later on, the idea of having paved streets proved to be a real asset for Marion. And I wrote another editorial about the need for sidewalks in Marion. There weren't any. Kids had to just walk in the mud. So that initiative started to take root. Citizens of Marion started thinking that was a good idea. And within a few years, Marion had more miles of sandstone sidewalks than any city its size in the country. I wrote an editorial on the need for a waterworks plant. Another one on the need for electric streetlights. I think that was about 1888, if I remember. And when Marion got street lights, they were turned on only on nights where there was no moonlight. A later editorial, a series of editorials, promoted the need for better transportation in Marion and electric streetcars with tracks in the middle of the streets and overhead wires powered up by the recently built electric plant that powered the streetcars up and down Center Street and Church Street and Main Street and State Street and Prospect Street. I wrote editorials about the need for more railroads in Marion. And in the end, we now have 5 railroads in Marion. Can you believe it? We've got the Chicago and Erie. We've got the New York, Penn, and Ohio. We've got the Cleveland, Cincinnati, Chicago, and St. Louis. It's called the Big Four. We've got the Columbus, Hocking Valley, and Toledo Railway, and the Columbus, Shawnee, and Hocking Railway. I wrote an editorial about the need for a new railroad depot. You see, we had, earlier, we had, each railroad had its own depot. And in fact, there were 3 major depots in Marion. And I wrote an editorial urging the community to consider finding a way to bring the railroads together and build one depot for the entire city. And that happened in 1902 with the construction of Union Depot. So those are the types of things that editorial opinion can do for a community. It can set the pace, set the agenda, get people thinking, get people behind an idea. And that's a very powerful platform.
You know, it's interesting, Mr. Harding, because you have now spoken about some of the great editorials that you wrote that you believe inspired a lot of change in Marion. Newspapers, by nature, in this era of the 1800s, early 1900s, are made or broken on sales. Do you believe it was the news stories or these editorials, which you speak very highly of, that sold the newspaper?
Well, the newspaper sold for 2 cents a copy. And when we, in the early years of the Star, if you wanted a copy of the newspaper, you went to the newspaper office, went to the counter, plopped down 2 pennies, and walked out with a copy. That's how you got the paper. Now, looking back on it, that seems like a primitive way to do it. My wife, Florence, never gets enough credit for her influence in building the Star to become a successful paper. In the early years of the Star, we had a cash register. I'm not sure why we had a cash register, because pretty much the only thing we had in the little drawer was collar buttons, a few pennies. There wasn't much in the way of subscribers. But my wife Florence had a great idea. She said, rather than having people come to the Star and office and buy a paper, what if we brought the paper to them? And what if, rather than coming in and just buying a paper, one now, one next week, what if you could actually subscribe to it and it came to you every day? This was an amazing new concept. And so we gave it a try. And sure enough, it was a raging success from the beginning. We recruited small boys up through early teenage years to deliver the papers. Florence hired them and trained them. And she was a stern teacher. If the paper boys were late or missed making a delivery or weren't current on their collections, they got a spanking. She gave, one Christmas, she gave each newspaper boy a whistle. So when the paper boy would come around and leave the paper for you, he blew the whistle to let you know that the paper was there. And the newspaper boy, of course, collected the money and brought it in. We didn't pay them well. We didn't have the money to do that. The boys were excited to get a little cash, and we were excited to get the paper moving off of the presses and out into people's hands. We were seeing the improvement in the cash flow coming into the paper, and Florence handled all of that. She was the business manager for the paper. She handled every cent that came into the place. Speaking of cents, everybody paid by pennies. Everything came in as pennies, and when it did, we put the we count them, keep track of everything, and we'd put the pennies in gallon jars, jugs, gallon jugs, you know, like cider comes in. And when the jug would get full, then I'd take a couple of them to the bank. It wasn't an uncommon sight for me to be seen walking down Center Street to the bank with a gallon jug of pennies under each arm. A gallon jug holds just over 5,000 pennies. It would be about $50 per jug. So I'd be on the way down to the bank with 2 gallon jugs with about $50 in cash each. And that's how we manage the money.
Mm-hmm. I do want to let the audience know again, we will be chatting with Warren G. Harding this morning for the full two-hour broadcast. This is the centennial of President Warren G. Harding being elected President of the United States November 2nd, 1920. And, of course, the date today, November 2nd, 2020. And we will explain to you how we're doing this interview at the end, so hang on for that. But President Harding, we have about 10 minutes left in our first hour here, and we did not talk about the formation of the Marion Star, how it came to be, how you came to it. You worked at newspapers in Iberia, in Caledonia. Tell us about the Star. How did it come to be?
Well, the Marion Star wasn't the Marion Star initially. It was started as the Marion Daily Pebble about 1877, I think. And it's hard to call it a newspaper, really. It was really a leaflet. It was a 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper folded in half, about the size of a church bulletin. It didn't do well. It really was just, I think, run as a hobby. And in the end, it went belly up and went to a sheriff's auction. Well, I was interested in buying it. I didn't have any money, but I borrowed a little bit from my father, and I had a couple partners. Jack Warwick was one. He's the one you remember that I was in Iberia with. He was my partner in crime for the Iberia paper. And then another fellow by the name of Benjamin Dempster, who was kind of a silent investor. He had a little bit of money, but didn't really play an active part. We pooled our money. I borrowed about $100 from my father. We each kicked in $100, and we bought the paper for $300 at the auction. It was a difficult start when we got it going. The paper had not much of a reputation. It was called the Marion Daily Star, but it wasn't published daily. Couldn't afford to publish it daily. So I nicknamed the paper the sick kitten. And that was our mission, to rescue the sick kitten and make it better. It was a long journey to do that. One of the things that made a difference was picking up political advertising. At the time, there were several newspapers in Marion. One of them was called the Marion Democratic Mirror. It's published by a guy by the name of Jim Vaughn. And actually, I worked for Jim Vaughn on that paper for a very brief period of time. It's not something I even put on my resume. I was fired when he asked me to write an editorial against James Blaine, who was the Secretary of State to James Garfield and a potential presidential candidate. Well, Blaine was a Republican. I'm a Republican. I refused to do that, refused to write that editorial, and was fired. So I was only there for a few weeks. The Star came after that. Anyway, we grew slowly. I think we purchased our first camera in 1885. If I remember right, the first photo was a circus parade passing in front of a Star building. That same year, we had a telephone installed. The phone number was 11. But I lost a partner in the paper over that telephone. Jack Warwick was furious that I would spend hard-earned money on a fad like a telephone. Nobody had a telephone. There wasn't a use for it. Why on earth would we need one of those at the newspaper? So he sold out his interest in the business. I bought it. And he exited the newspaper business over a telephone. Yeah, it was kind of interesting. When we first got the phone, one of the questions was, how do we answer it? There was a lot of discussion about that. Alexander Bell, who invented it, was promoting the idea that when you answered the phone, you should say, hello. But one of my good friends was Thomas Edison. We'll talk about that later, but Thomas Edison was a proponent of answering the phone with ahoy. So that's how I've been answering the phone in deference to my friend Thomas Edison. So every time the phone rings and I pick it up, it's ahoy.
Now there's a little known fact. Now, Warren Harding, I have a question for you here. We are in the last 5 minutes of hour number one, and in hour number two, Warren Harding will stay with us, and we will talk about his transition into politics. But it's interesting, because you mentioned two things in the last 20 minutes that I think people are interested by. And by the way, your wife, Florence Harding, will be on this station with me tonight from 7:10 p.m. until 9 p.m., so stay tuned for that interview tonight on this station. Now, the thing is, as you said, the Marion Star was considered a sick kitten. That's how you referred to it when you took control of it, that it wasn't making a whole lot of money. And you've also mentioned how your wife, Florence, made a lot of good changes. Paperboys, things of that nature. And the story is, here you running for office in 1920, is that she was really the brains. That left up to you, it may not have succeeded, it wouldn't have been a big money maker. That she was the one who came in, she had the business sense, and that she also was the stern hand, you talked about her spanking people, that made that a success. Is that the truth?
Absolutely, that's the truth. I can't give Florence enough credit for being the business mind behind the star. As I mentioned earlier, I'm a word person. I'm not good with numbers. I never have been. But Florence is very strong at that. Florence, her father was Amos Kling, and he, well known throughout Marion, operated a department store, a hardware store downtown on Main Street. Actually, going way back, he sold supplies to the Union Army during the Civil War. And in the earlier days of that store, the family lived upstairs. In fact, Florence was born above the hardware store and started working there at an early age, unpacking shipments, stocking shelves, starting to deal with some of the accounting. And so she learned at an early age how to track money, how to make the books come out even, the difference between profit and loss, and how to turn one into the other. And so she came to the star well trained in business retail, and so she brought that mentality to the paper and really put it on a firm track. I can't thank her enough for the difference she made.
Tell us, before our first hour is up here, and next hour we're going to talk about your transition into politics from journalism, but tell us how you met Florence. How did that turn into a marriage?
Well, my sister, Kat, needed piano lessons. And my father was willing to pay for those, and Florence was well known in the Marion community as a very proficient piano teacher. She really had a gift for music, and in fact, her father sent her to the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music to study music, which was really unheard of at that time in the late 1800s. You just didn't spend money on your daughter like that. Amos Kling did, and Florence benefited from it, and really was a great talent at the piano, and really had a talent for teaching others. So my sister Chat took lessons. That's how I first met Florence, and I was greatly impressed with this woman. I certainly wouldn't call her a beauty. She didn't strike me that way. What struck me was her presence, her intelligence, her musical talent. And as I got to know her better, I learned that she was an expert horsewoman, English style, side saddle, very proficient at that. She also loved the roller skate, which is something that we would do on some of our earlier dates. Roller skating was a big fad at the time, and Marion had three roller rinks, and all of them were packed. And Florence was amazing on skates. She could skate forwards and backwards, and she could dance on skates. And of course, I was just a clumsy oaf, but we had fun. And she also loved to go for rides in the automobile. And we had a lot of automobile dates. I had a Stevens Duryea. It was, I think it was about a 1903 model. I bought it used, so it was much later than that. It was a 5-horsepower runabout. When it sold new, it was probably about $1,200. I didn't pay anywhere near that for it. But Florence really enjoyed that car and loved to ride in it, liked to learn to drive. It was a flathead engine, water-cooled, twin cylinder, which was actually mounted amidships in the car, right near the seats. Had a 4-speed gearbox, and she could just rip through those gears. It had wire wheels, and it didn't have a steering wheel. It had a tiller that you would move to the left or right. You'd steer it like a boat. It was a dark green in color. And Florence loved that car, and we had a lot of good memories in it.
Mr. Harding, before we have to take our break here, but we are coming back with Warren G. Harding talking about the transition from journalism to politics in the next hour. I want to ask you this about this marriage. Two quick questions, very quick, because we only have a minute here. But it is known, I don't know if it was well known at the time, but Florence had been married before to Pete DeWolf and had a child. Did that matter to you?
It did in the beginning, but those differences mellowed away. Actually, I think the bigger issue for me was that Florence was older than me by 5 years. Some would argue that she was much more mature than I am. Marrying a divorced woman at the time was really quite a scandal. It wasn't socially acceptable to be divorced, much less marry a divorcee, and one that had a young child. Florence and her father came to odds over the child. His name was Marshall, and shortly after Marshall was born, for one thing, Amos kicked Florence out of the house. It was very difficult for Florence to earn a living. She did so with piano lessons and became ultimately very successful with that, but not in the early days. It was very difficult for her to sustain herself, and so her father took Marshall in and raised him as a Kling. In fact, Marshall on and off used the Kling name. Sometimes he went by Marshall DeWolf, sometimes he went by Marshall Kling. Florence didn't have a lot of influence over Marshall during those early years. So yes, even though she had a child, that didn't have a lot of impact on our marriage, because Marshall stayed with Amos and Louisa, his wife.
Warren, I want you to think about this question. We're going to open up the next hour with it, and then we're going to go into the transition from your journalistic days to your political days. We've talked about how Florence was a smart woman, probably the success for the Marion Star more than you. She was older than you. She'd been married. She'd had a child. She'd had a falling out with her father, who was a businessman here in Marion. Think about this question, and we're going to come back and answer it. You also referred to her as not a beauty. Did you love Florence Harding, or were you in love with her? The answer to that on the other side of this break, the centennial of the election of President Warren G. Harding, November 2nd, 2020. Warren Harding's the guest. Come back in 10 minutes.
Founded by police officers and reporters, but none of them was looking down. They were high. I saw it.